Welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pod of Thunder and Rock and Roll. And today, doing his first in-depth, long-form interview since the Guns N' Roses reunion tour started in 2016, Duff McKagan returns to Talk is Jericho. GNR are on a press gag order since the reunion started. They've done no interviews. They've spoken to nobody. They've explained nothing to anybody. But Duff decided he wanted to come hang out with me on Talk is Jericho. We have so much fun whenever we do the show. And we're talking about the reunion, what the rehearsals were like before the tour got started, how the shows have been going. And as you know, this year is the 30th anniversary of the classic Appetite for Destruction album. So we're talking about the making of that record, where some of the song ideas came from, the riffs, Duff sharing some cool info about what inspired the guitar and bass licks, even lyrics. Duff's also talking about the early Guns N' Roses tour, how they ended up on the road with the Cult. We did this interview exactly 30 years after I first saw Guns N' Roses in 1987 in Winnipeg, opening for the Cult when Duff was still walking through the crowd trying to scam change from people to make some money. How the crowds literally blew up after Sweet Child of Mine was released a few months after that. Duff's got great stories about producer Mike Klink, how he started working with Guns N' Roses because nobody else would. And if you're wondering about Duff's chemistry with original drummer Steven Adler and how they locked in as a tight rhythm section, Duff's going to tell you about that as well. He's also going to tell you what he and Izzy did to Steven and his drum kit in those early days. Wait till you hear it. A hilarious story. So many funny stories from Duff McKagan, and so many more funny stories from my fourth book, No is a Four-Letter Word. It came out this week, and you can get it at Amazon at amazon.com/shop/IamJericho. It's a self-help book that basically I put together featuring the 20 principles to help all you sexy beast Talk as Jericho fans achieve all your dreams. The Gene Simmons principle: always look like a star. The Vince McMahon principle: work hard, then work harder. The Brian Pillman principle: if you want to do something, you got to do something different. The Paul Stanley principle: eliminate negativity. The Chris Jericho principle: believe in yourself. The Ronnie James Dio principle: give everyone their moment. So many great thoughts and lessons that I have learned over the years and that have enabled me to achieve all of my goals and make all my dreams come true. And they're all encapsulated in No is a Four-Letter Word. The press tour continues on, and I am in Los Angeles tonight doing a book signing at Barnes & Noble at The Grove, 7 p.m. if you're in L.A. and you want to say hello and get your book signed. That is on a Wednesday night, 7 o'clock at Barnes & Noble at The Grove. Come say hi. Come get a copy of Noah's A Four-Letter Word signed, and tell me about how your life has been impacted by this book. I'm telling you, you're going to love it. And the signings have been great. Thanks to everyone who's been coming out. I'm so glad to meet all you guys and sign some stuff for you. And I'm so glad to bring you an exclusive Guns N' Roses interview. Duff McKagan back on Talk is Jericho. And we're going to get right into the Guns N' Roses reunion. But first, I want to know what you guys think of the A&E TV show, Leah Remini, Scientology in the Aftermath. It is absolutely insane. It's so riveting. I hope you guys have been watching. I know I have. And this is actually season two. I binge-watched the first season, and this second season has proven to be just as fascinating. 10 new episodes that follow Leah, along with high-level former Scientology executives, church members, as they delve deep into the shocking stories of abuse, heartbreak, disconnection, harassment experienced by those who left the church and are now speaking publicly about their experiences. Riveting, riveting stuff. Leah continues her quest to give a voice to the victims of the Church of Scientology. They are bullies in a lot of ways, but she is the brave face helping others speak up and overcome their experiences. And in this new season, the series is exploring accounts of former members whose lives have been significantly impacted by the church's practices. Leah Remini is helping people take action. She's turning survivors into fighters. She's revealing truth. She's seeking justice, and she's doing it on Leah Remini's Scientology in the Aftermath. You can watch the first season online, on demand, and on the A&E app. And then you can watch season two every Tuesday night, 9 Eastern, 8 Central on A&E. Trust me, you do not want to miss this show. It is so sobering, and it's a very much a riveting show, and I recommend it 100%. Go check it out now. Leah Remini's Scientology in the Aftermath on A&E. Do it now.
Talk is Jericho.
Hold on a second. I have to turn this power strip on. Sorry.
I just spit in my own room and then I apologize to Jericho.
So we're in Canada and you were noticing that everybody says sorry all the time, right?
Yeah, they just do. It's like
it's a reaction. It's just like an instinct. Sorry.
It's like in America, we might say, like, okay.
Yeah.
You know, totally. You don't even notice you say it. Okay.
Totally. So we were hanging out last night here, and it's super funny because I have a show in town, like a spoken word show, and super coincidental that Guns N' Roses is playing the night before, mm-hmm. and even more coincidental that we're staying in the same hotel on the same floor.
Is it coincidental?
That's what I was thinking. I was thinking Duff's going to think that I was like following you guys or something. But the guy who set me up here was like, I got you on the same floor as Guns N' Roses. And I was like, are you kidding me? This is great. So, we're literally down the road. Like three
yeah, I think we're on this would be my floor.
Yeah.
And I think, I don't know.
You guys have, this is literally your floor. So like the other guys are on other floors of this place? I don't know.
But what we do get like, kind of the same rooms.
Uh-huh.
So it'll be three floors in a row. We'll be one on top of each other.
Oh, so like that. Slash is 18. Well, we can say this because by the time this airs, we're not here anymore. So we're in room 923. That's the room that Duff was in.
Mm-hmm.
So 19. So Slash should be 18?
Whatever.
Or whatever.
Yeah. Could be.
But we were hanging out last night in the lounge. Yeah. And we were talking about
on the 19th floor.
On the 19th
floor lounge.
In the lounge of the Fairmont Hotel in Winnipeg. We're given all the information because at this point in time.
Which I call the Fancyton Suites. Any place we stay is always the Fancyton.
And I'm so stupid that when you said you're staying at the Fancyton Suites, I Googled Fancyton Suites. There's no such place.
Where is it? There's no such place.
The Fancy Pants Suite. But we were here last night and you're is he like your bodyguard? Your assistant?
He security, yeah.
Security, right. Mm-hmm. Which obviously, you know, you got to have being in Guns N' Roses with your own floor. But he was freaking out that I saw you guys.
So, so Tadao is my security guy. And we roll together every place I go. Mm-hmm. I go to the gym with him. We've just become really kind of close because of it. It's a good thing we kind of pair up. Okay, he's very quiet. I can be quiet, but I'm really not so quiet.
You're an outgoing guy.
I'm outgoing. Yeah. He's not, but he's really funny. And the islanders, the Polynesians, they have a really, I don't want to generalize them all, but they kind of have this really easy island gait about them, you know, this whole style. But Chris Jericho walks in the 19th floor lounge last night at 11:30, whatever it was. And Tadao, who I've never seen kind of freak out. And him freaking out again is very low-key. I only knew he was freaking out because I know him so well. But he freaked out because Chris Jericho walked in. He was like, I could tell he was like, oh.
Because, like you say, he didn't really say anything.
Mm-mm.
And then we took a picture together and he posted. He's like, I was with the legendary Chris. Like, legendary, right? But he was like super excited, which he actually would hashtag tour perks. Like one of the perks of being on tour is you get to meet.
Hashtag, that's great. You know, so like Tadao, if he gets excited, I can tell by one eyebrow moves. Whoa.
He's super
that's like you or
up.
Me doing like jumping
yeah,
jacks.
We're just like, ah. So did you just meet him recently or has he been with you for a few years?
Since Dodger Stadium. So for a year, you know.
So out of curiosity, did they say like, this is going to be your guy, or did you do an audition to find a guy?
It's
or?
Funny, yeah. I mean, talking about security details and stuff, right? Because you'll go and see, you'll be in a group of like Slipknot. Mm-hmm. You'll be at the hotel and you'll see their guys. I've gotten to know different security details, and sometimes they cross over to other bands, of course. So you see the guys, and they're like, I wonder how they got those guys, right?
Right.
And in our case, so Chemo, there's a guy.
That's Slash's guy.
Right. Yeah. And he's been with other bands throughout the years. And in the case of my guy, Tadao, Chemo and Tadao are cousins.
Okay.
So I had a guy before this, Tim Medbets, who's my bro. He was also head of security for the Hells Angels for 8 years. So he was out with me. I've climbed mountains with Tim.
Like literally.
Yeah. He's done Everest 3 times and the 7 highest in the world. And he has this foundation where he takes legless and armless vets up the highest mountains in the world. Yeah. And he's just a wonderful dude and he's a badass and he's my bro and he rides Harleys and et cetera, et cetera. So he was my guy for the first 7 months of this tour, 6 months. Mm-hmm. But he has an injury. He got in a bad motorcycle accident a bunch of years ago, and he finally had to get his...
Like surgery or whatever?
Well, he had to get in. He's got like metal up and down the spine.
Gotcha.
There was a show called Everest on Discovery. Mm-hmm. And if anybody's seen that, he was Biker Tim on that. Oh. He got in a really bad accident, and they said he'd never walk again and blah, blah, blah. But he climbed Everest.
Hmm.
So he's a fantastic guy. But he had to finally get that surgery on his ankle. They wasn't sure if they were going to save his foot.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to take the time off. So Tadao came in. End up hanging with these.
Well, yeah. Guys.
And so that's why I brought Tim, because we climb mountains together. We hang alone in solitude in the, you know, 10
right.
below. And
right.
we get along well. So Tadao coming out was like, well, that's a big part of it. Can we hang? Because you eat dinner together every night. You travel together. You do everything together. And Tadao is so cool. He's so mellow, you know. And then he'll come out of his room, and he's got a little speaker, and he's got like the newest pop. Newest Taylor Swift and Katy Perry and Bieber and stuff. And that's our walking music down the hall into the elevator, you know.
He's playing it as you guys are walking.
It's our walking music.
And this is the thing, like you know, and we're joking and stuff like that. And obviously you and I are bros, and you're super humble and super cool. But to get to the level when you need – security, and obviously Guns N' Roses, this is a huge stadium tour. Mm-hmm. So what exactly is he doing? Is he just kind of, is he the guy that kind of leads you from A to B, your day to day? Is there, I doubt there's fans trying to like accost you where he has to go like, get out of here.
Let's see. There is that.
It is that, okay.
North America's, you got, it's more eBayers.
Isn't that brutal?
It's brutal. And I'm sure you deal with it
all the time. These people show up at the airport, and I'm like, how did you know what flight I'm on?
They know what flight you're on?
Like, if I had to pick you up from the airport, and I say, hey, my friend Duff's on a flight, what flight is he on? They would say, sorry, sir, we can't give you that information.
But they know it.
But yet you land, there's fans there with all the pictures and whatever.
Because, you know, there's got to be money exchanged there.
I agree, yeah.
And there's particular airlines. I'll say it. American Airlines sells their information.
Really?
For sure. For sure. Every time you land at JFK on American, they're there.
And there's a whole posse of them there.
Posse, L.A., same thing.
Yeah.
American. It seems to be American more than others.
Okay.
Certain hotels in Manhattan.
Really?
Like, wow. I'm here for 12 hours. I'm not even spending the night here.
Yeah.
How did you know I was going to be here?
Right.
You know?
Yeah. I even asked that. So, like, how did
We're not even playing a gig here.
We're here, like, doing, like, you have a day room. Because you're traveling somewhere, whatever.
Yeah, it happened last week. I was in Manhattan for, me and Slash and I were there for, you know, 12 hours. And there they are.
Yeah.
At a random hotel.
How do you know this? Right. So what does Tadao do in that situation?
So he calls ahead. You know, like, that's not a life-threatening thing.
No, of course.
So I don't mean to make it a bigger thing than it is. If you're tired, that's the main thing is you're tired. And, you know, you're just out here, you're trying to get to the gym. You're trying to eat something good. You're trying to get coffee. And you're trying to get to your gig or whatever the thing you got to do.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it. So, and you don't want to, like, germs. And, like, in that case, like, germs and stuff. You want to come in the back. Mm-hmm. That day, I had strep throat. So, I didn't want to deal.
Wow.
I had strep throat for, like, a week and a half out here, which, you know, as a singer.
It's brutal.
Is brutal. So I was on steroids and, you know, stuff.
Because you sing during the show as well. You have your own song even that you sing during the set.
But I did a lot of, like, falsetto backups.
You're doing a lot of I noticed that when I saw you last year. You're doing singing throughout the whole show.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's kind of, you know, falsetto, especially. Mm-hmm. You can't be singing. You can't be full voiced. So you can't, you know, so luckily we have Melissa Reese with us, and she's a vocal coach.
Oh.
She is such an amazing singer.
She plays keyboards and she sings, yeah.
She sings a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And her and I sing a lot of, like, just duo vocals. So she's like, dude, okay, here's what you got to do. And she, like, coached me through that.
So what is she, just from a singing standpoint, like, what was she saying? Like, is she talking about if you're sick, here's what you got to do, or just in general?
Strep throat. She's got it down to exactly, here's what's going on. Physically with your vocal cords, and strep is right here, and let me look, shine the flashlight up. Okay. Oh, yeah. Okay. Don't touch me, you know.
So how do you sing when you have that problem?
So you know when you yawn?
Mm-hmm.
And you open up the back of your palate?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to sing, like you got to sing all the way up there, like you're yawning. That mm-hmm. that part in the back of your palate, when you're yawning, you have to push from your lower abs up to that yawning part.
Hmm.
You got to, like, you know, close your mouth in, like you're saying ooh the whole time.
Right.
When you sing, not like she says, I look at you downstage when you're singing and your mouth is wide. Close it up.
Oh.
Put your shoulders back. I'm like, but I got the bass on. I'm like, yeah, you're all trying to look cool and stuff. I'm not trying to look cool. I just got my bass on. I'm singing. This is how I've sang for 30 years. Well, you got to lift your shoulders up and pull them back and put them back down. And
interesting.
Put your chest up and sing from your lower abs and blah, blah, blah.
Really?
Yeah.
It's funny because I met Smokey Robinson once.
Yeah?
And yeah, he was eating lemons. And I just went up to him and say, so, you know, Smokey, does lemons, does that help you with your voice? Is that like for your throat? He's like, no, man, I just like eating lemons.
Ah, that's great.
And he said, the only thing that helps you as a singer for it was water and sleep. He said, the rest of that shit, you know, throat coat and all that stuff. He says, that's all bullshit for me. And he's like, obviously one of the greatest singers of all time for 50 years. And so I always kind of took that, his advice, sleeping and water. And,
yeah, you don't sleep, though.
Well, that's the thing.
I know you, Chris Jericho. What do you do, about 3-4 hours a night, maybe?
4 or 5 hours a night. 4 or 5 hours a night.
4 or 5.
Once in a while, it'll be a little bit longer, but usually 5 is the norm. That's it. My mind is moving too much, and I've got stuff going on.
I get it.
How is it for you when you're on the road? Because you guys have a lot of days off as well, right?
We do, yeah. Yeah, you definitely, like, I'm in a thing right now. You know when you get on the road and you get in your...
Talking about in your groove, like in your zone, groove. Your routine?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we just, and like, I can go, I traveled from, 2 months ago, I traveled from Tel Aviv to Seattle to go to the dentist. We were supposed to have 9 days off, but we put this Apollo show in New York City.
Right
in the middle of our 9 days off. So I'm like, but I had to go to the dentist. I had to get this temporary, taken off this root canal and put the permanent on.
Yeah.
My dentist's going, dude, if that thing comes off, you're screwed.
Right.
You want to keep your teeth or what?
Yeah.
I'm like, yeah, I want to keep my teeth. Well, come to. So I was going to go to, you know, I was going to go home for 9 days and get my tooth fixed and blah, blah, blah. But I couldn't. So I flew from Tel Aviv, which is Middle Eastern time, whatever that is.
Yeah. Israeli in time or whatever.
11 hours ahead of Seattle.
Yeah.
Flew to Seattle, slept that night, went to the dentist in the morning, got it done, flew to Manhattan. So that's back over across the country.
Mm-hmm.
Got there, went and got some Mr. Softy ice cream and stuff, went to the gym, went to bed.
Yeah.
Got up, did sound check. It was hot. Sound check, did the Apollo show, which we played late. New York time, because it wanted to be midnight, because the 30th anniversary of Appetite, right? Mm-hmm. So we want to play at midnight at the time.
Whatever. The exact moment, yeah.
So we did that, and went to the hotel, slept for 1 hour, because I got on the Dark 30 flight back to my family.
Gotcha.
Right? And my point to all that, in all of that, I experienced no jet lag, because you're zoning in on this thing. You're mm-hmm. going to attack this thing and you're not going to have jet lag. But going from Eastern time, Montreal, Ottawa, Miami, Hershey, Pennsylvania, where we've been for a while, just to the Central time.
That messed you up.
In Winnipeg. I'm kind of messed up.
Yeah. But it's funny though, like you mentioned, like your dentist, right? And it's the same, like...
Like, you have to go to the dentist.
But you'd be like, well, then why don't you just go to, like, no, you have to go to your dentist.
Yeah.
Like, that's the way, like, it's yours.
It's my dentist.
You know? Like, even for me, like I'm growing my hair out a little bit. It's going to end up probably looking a little bit like yours when I'm done.
Mine's a mess right now.
Well, so is mine. But the reason I have this hair is because I was on tour for a month. Then I came back and my hairstylist was on vacation for a month. And I'm not going to go to just anybody. No. I want to go to her.
I've gotten some mullets because I've gone one person. Yeah.
And it's like, since I can't go to her, I got 2 months of hair now. I'm just going to keep going and see where it ends up. But I think people would not understand that. Like, you want to go to your dentist, your hairstylist. So it's worth it flying all the way across the country to go, right? To yours.
Yeah, yeah. Like, seeing a doctor. Like, I got strep throat, right? I saw a doctor and I have a heart murmur. I've had it since I was a kid.
Right.
So I know what's coming. And then also I've done a bunch of drugs in my 20s, right? So I know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
I can call it. He's going to look up my nose. He's going to go, oh my God. Okay, I did a bunch of cocaine in my 20s, man. I know. I've had 2 surgeries. Jeez, wow. It was a long, I don't do drugs anymore. If you're looking for a drug, you know, like.
Yeah.
And then they put the thing on, they want to listen to my lungs, right? You got a heart murmur. Did anybody told you? Yeah, Mr. Bedside Manor. Yes, I know. I'm not going to die. I'm pretty sure right now.
I got it.
Does it sound like I'm going to die?
Yeah.
You should get that checked out. No, I'm good. Thanks. But now I'll freak out all night. But thanks. Cool.
Yeah, you're worried all night, right?
Yeah.
Talk is Jericho.
I was afraid, like, you're on tour and playing these big rooms, big venues, big places, but you're completely sober and have been for about 15 years now?
Oh.
10 years?
Well, no. I mean, I've been off the booze since 94.
94. And completely sober from all the other shit, too?
Yeah. Yep.
So when you're on tour now, I mean, and we've toured together in the UK and Australia, but now in these big, you know, playing stadiums, is it different? Like, do you think back to what you used to do, like, in the 90s when you had days off? Like, now you're going to the gym and...
I mean, my days off have been the same thing, though, for a long time.
Okay.
Now, which is gym. Whatever kind of physical activity, which is going to be something. It's always extreme.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the one thing I had to start to figure out. How do you get that same part in your, tap that same place in your head without going so extreme? Because I'm like doing all kinds of supplements now and vitamineral green, like, and even tried cannabinoids for joints. You know, have you tried that?
No. What is it?
You know, CBD oil?
Yeah.
So a doctor gave it to me. There's a study. It's really good for, like, joints.
Mm-hmm.
Getting in, like, after 50. And so it actually worked. It doesn't get you high or anything. It's just
But it's almost like this type of stuff is your new addiction, like the healthy
stuff. Well, no, I'm trying to find, is there a mixture of stuff I can do and still go hard in the gym and not be so damn sore?
Mm-hmm.
I work out 7 days a week. How do I take a rest day?
And plus you're doing the 3-hour shows three days a week, right?
2-3 days a week.
Yeah. And that's very taxing.
And we're picking it up because we're going to do an arena run in the fall.
Right.
So then we won't have to move a huge stage. That's why we only play 2-3 times a week, is because we have a couple stages going.
Like one stage is being set up now in the next venue. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But when you're playing a stadium show, like you mentioned, you've got a big stadium stage that you have to cover. That's
why you see big bands. They're only playing a couple times a week. Mm-hmm. You're going, oh, well, those guys are really slowing down. But no, you know, you have to set this whole thing up. If you walk into a stadium and you see Paul McCartney or some big band or us playing, everything there, including the seats on the ground, you know, are ours. We've either rented those seats.
Really?
It's like we're putting on an NFL football game.
Wow. Even the seats. I never thought about that.
Yeah. Oh, but back to the security thing. What I wanted to get to on that, in all seriousness, so there's personal security guys that we have, but that's not real. Like all this eBay stuff and all that. South America is crazy. You need to have...
It's like Beatlemania there, right?
It's like
insane, right? Yeah.
Europe, like Italy and some... It's Justin Bieber stuff, you know, Beatlemania. Mm-hmm. It really is. Mm-hmm. And that's a thing. But, you know, in this day and age, we went and played Slane Castle in Dublin 3 days after the Ariana Grande thing in Manchester.
See. Right.
So, in every place, all these places are on high alert. So we have a full security detail at the venue. We have advanced guys, and they're all, you know, ex-SEAL team guys, all this stuff. And then they coordinate with the police. So, and whoever else, to make sure that the people coming to see us are safe.
Gotcha.
You know, we have a way out. I'm not worried about me.
Right.
But you're worried about you're putting on a big show. You have a bunch of people coming to see you. There's a responsibility to that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think we feel it pretty greatly and pretty gravely sometimes. And so that show, same promoter, the Manchester show was our promoter 3 days later.
In Slane, wow.
In Slane.
And that's a big gig.
It's 60 miles as the crow flies from Manchester to Dublin. It's pretty close. Maybe too close for comfort. Mm-hmm. You're putting on this 85,000 people.
Gig, yeah. Slane,
you know?
Right.
So there's all the way to the train stations and you know, see something, say something. All of that was... and the security all throughout Europe was really great. And they had... I think they had the crowd as safe as they could get it.
Mm-hmm.
Some places we played, there was helicopters circling.
Wow.
You know, with a guy hanging out.
With the gun, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
That gets your attention as you're playing. You're like, wow, there's a guy.
Sure, and that's the world that we live in now.
Yeah.
You know? We did a show in Paris a week after the Bataclan with the Eagles Death Metal.
Yeah.
We did a show 1 week later.
And you guys were in, weren't you in St. Louis like a few days after the...
Good, yeah, dude, with the Ferguson thing. That's right. And both the shows, I mean, like... There's small crowds because who the hell is going to go to a rock show? But for us, we wanted to do it because you don't want to cancel, because you don't want to let them win, quote unquote. But I'll tell you what, the one in Paris a week after this massive shooting massacre, you know, I'm watching the door, the back of the room, in case, right? But we didn't want to cancel it. And the people that showed up had a great time and they needed it. But it's scary though, man. You know, it's like I said, you know, you just never know what's going to go down. And like you said, we can just run out the back. You know, there's always a way for the band to escape. But it's for the fans and the people out there that you're worried for them in a lot of ways, you know?
Yeah, I mean, you say you can just run out the back. You hope.
Right.
But you think you're playing the show, so you're kind of the last person you're worried about.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure there's a certain part of you is like, okay, what's my strategy?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
I had my escape route planned. Yeah. And I do that actually every time, because another thing we did was the night that there was that fire at the Great White Show in Rhode Island. Mm-hmm. Remember that?
Yeah.
We played that night as well in Albany, New York, which was right down the road.
Yeah.
So every time I do a show, I always look at where's my escape route if a fire breaks out. You know what I mean? You just have to think that way. I don't know, it's shitty, but that's just how you think, right?
Yeah.
So when you're talking about doing these big shows, and it's interesting because it's a very cool coincidence that August 24th, 1987, I saw Guns N' Roses for the first
time.
Today
is August 24th.
August 24th, 2017. Here you are playing the stadium.
Slash brought that up. See, I think
I texted to Slash as well. Did he tell you about it? You know, Slash is always so cool. He's like, wow, what a coincidence. But it's cool that he actually thought enough of it to bring it up.
Hey, man, Jericho texted me and he said, here's the deal. Yeah. Yeah,
do you remember, do you remember that tour with the Cult? Because I think that was your first tour, right?
Oh, I remember it well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I really do. I mean, that was the first arena tour I'd ever done.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a tour bus, like a real tour bus. And, you know, of course, the tour bus was 20 years old at the time.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, the first night we were in Halifax, our bus driver got rolled for his float by a hooker. but it didn't matter. We were on I remember having no money on that tour and going through the audience after we played. It's like, you didn't change. So I could make a phone call.
Dude, I'm going to tell you something right now.
Did I come up to you and ask for change?
No, you didn't. But you were at the back of the arena selling the buttons on your jacket for $5 each in the middle of the crowd. And I know this because I just talked to my cousin Chad. I said, what was Duff doing? Because we saw you. And he said he was selling the pins on his jacket for $5 a piece.
Yeah.
So you're just in the middle of the crowd.
Yeah, so catering on that. Wow, they got catering. There's food.
Yeah.
So there was a meal on gig days that you could have, but we had no money. There was like we had no per diem. We had no money.
Right.
So it was like, okay, well, you guys are on tour. It's great. We had Mick Bob, who's my tech still.
Mm-hmm.
We just celebrated 30 years.
Yeah, Mick Bob, yeah.
Yeah.
30 years. 30 That's years. Crazy.
We had, he and I had dinner in Buffalo.
Mm-hmm.
30 years. So that was 30 years ago, wasn't it?
Exactly 30 years. So he
started in Halifax. That was his first gig. It was just Mick Bob and another guy then.
I'm sure you didn't have a big crew. Yeah.
We had two guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which was like huge to us. We have two guys. And a backdrop. And it was probably like 4x8, right. The backdrop. But yeah, I remember the tour very well. You know, being broke or any of that stuff didn't matter. I did so many punk rock tours where you had no place to stay. You would like get to the show and you would find there would always be a punk rock house that you could sleep at. So you just
the band house.
There was some band house somewhere in wherever you were at, Eugene, Oregon. There was some kid's house. Well, you know, sometimes you'd sleep at somebody's mom's house.
Right.
So I wasn't worried about that. We had a tour bus. You could always go to the bus.
Yeah.
Right.
Sleep on that. Yeah.
So we went, started in Halifax, came across Canada and played the hockey rinks and some theaters, came down the West Coast, went through my hometown of Seattle, and it was amazing. Played the Paramount, this place. I'd seen the Clash and all these, the Police,
classic
all these
place,
great bands. I saw the Clash pre-London Calling at this place.
At the Paramount.
That now we're playing. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a big deal. Came back down through L.A., then across the Southwest through Texas, and ended in New Orleans. And I remember the tour very well.
Because at that point in time, I remember, like, no one, at least up here in Winnipeg, no one knew who you were.
No, nobody
never heard of you guys or anything about Guns N' Roses. And I remember the guy came on stage, maybe it was Mick Bob, and he was like, of all the bands in the world, this is one of them. Here's Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, it was Mick Bob.
And then you walk out there, plug in, and start It's So Easy. And I was like, who the fuck are these guys?
Yeah.
Bunch of scums. What a bunch of bums. You know?
Yeah. And we came back through a few months later with Iron Maiden.
With Iron Maiden. That's right.
And that crowd, you know, the cult crowd was a little more like a rock and roll.
It's a little bit more similar to the vibe of Guns N' Roses than Maiden would be.
Maiden's crowd were like, who the hell are these? But you just go out and you do the shows, you know. We are thankful to Iron Maiden for that tour, but we toured a lot where nobody knew who we were, mostly on that Appetite for Destruction tour. We were out for a year.
Well, because it's funny because Appetite came out, like you said, in July of '87. I actually did a bit of research.
Yeah,
one thing, but it didn't take off till about a year later.
Yeah.
Which is unbelievable in this day and age that you had a whole year before the album.
And it wasn't normal back then either. Mm-hmm. You know, they're about to pull us off the road. We had tour support, so that paid for the bus and the crew guys. And, of course, we had to pay it all back.
If you have a hot dog on the record company, you're paying it back.
Of course. Yeah. Right.
Eventually.
Yeah, with interest.
Yeah.
Those are all things you don't know then.
And they don't ever really tell you either.
No.
Yeah.
But, so we toured for a year. We'd go to London. We'd go to the UK and stuff. And we were blowing up there. It was such a strange thing to go there. And, like, we sold out the Hammersmith Odeon. Hmm. That's 2,500 people or something, right?
Yeah.
And we sold out other big theater in the UK. And then we'd come back to America and it'd be like three people up front, like, yeah, that's our band. That's our three people.
Yeah, sure.
And then we'd go to Japan, and it was a thing there. Australia was a thing. Come back to the States, nothing. But when it started to pick up, it really, we were on the Aerosmith tour. So we did, what did we do? We did Alice Cooper tour.
Mm-hmm.
We were the first of three.
Really?
Yeah, through the Midwest. So that's like, you know, it's us, Megadeth, Alice Cooper.
Another strange bill, right?
Yeah. So you got to set up in front of not only Alice Cooper's stuff, but Megadeth stuff.
There's Alice's drum set, Megadeth's drum set, then your drum set.
At the very front, the lip. So you'd have to, there was gigs where you had to jump over the the bass drum to get to the other side of the stage. The Cult were nice enough to give us that first tour, and you know, they saw us at the Marquee in London, and we're like, we want to take those guys on tour. We think that band's killer.
They saw it before anybody else.
And so always thankful to them, and made all the bands that took us out. Motley Crue, again, our three people were up front. Yay. In the South, the rest of the people were like, who? We're just filing in.
We want Tommy Lee.
And then the Aerosmith tour, Sweet Child of Mine single came out, and it went from 3 to 30, you know, to 300, all in, like, I swear, a couple weeks.
And I remember too.
3,000 to everybody got there. To see us.
And then you're almost bigger than the headlining.
Well, you know. we had that new breaking band.
Yeah.
Stigma.
Right.
So people were really excited. Aerosmith, of course, are Aerosmith. Bands you just don't compete with.
Right.
They're Aerosmith.
Sure.
But we had that fresh, shiny vibe. Everybody had to see us. So,
right. Just on the strength of that one song.
Then they would, you know, get the record and go, oh my God, you know, I like this song and that song. And so, that was a really interesting time, you know, going from asking people for change so you could make a phone call.
We
still didn't have any money, but everybody knew. The thing is, like, everybody knew who you were suddenly. You'd go into grocery store when you got back to LA, and we were on the cover of the Rolling Stone, and but you don't change at all. You're like, well, this is, I gotta buy some copies for sure. It's like that song,
buy five copies for my mother.
But then people are looking at you at the store, like, and pointing, there's a guy. And I was like, wow, that's weird. It's so weird. Hi, you know, like, you know, that odd thing where you don't know what to say. Hello. How's my voice sound when I say that? Hello. Hi. How am I supposed to even say that? Yes, it's me.
Yeah.
I'm that guy. I don't know what to even say, you know.
And it's like we said the classic line of, are you who I think you are? Yeah. It's like, who do you think I am? I don't know.
Depends on who you think I am. I'm pretty sure it depends on that.
I was telling you last night that
I like your answer.
People say to me, like, you're a lot smaller in person, and I always say, like, well, I'm actually not even this big. But Tadeo posted the picture, and right underneath on his Instagram, someone goes, "Wow, he's a lot smaller than I thought." And I was gonna text back, I'm actually not even that big. So that's always the thing, though.
You should.
I should.
You're listening to Talk is Jericho.
Let's talk about Appetite for Destruction as the record. So this is basically your first record.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are now, 30 million copies later. When you guys was there a buzz about Guns N' Roses when you're doing this record where you're like, you obviously never know, but did you know you had something special at the time doing something that no one was really doing?
We had an incredible belief in ourselves.
Yeah.
You know, even from the very beginning, like when that band got together, we all knew, like, well, this is the thing that we've all wanted to do.
Mm-hmm.
We've been in a bunch of bands before this. This is the band.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go out and play club shows in LA, and again, like, it was three people and we knew them all. It was like Wes Arkeen, my next door neighbor, somebody's girlfriend, and their friend.
Yeah, Del James
from The Office. And then Del and those guys came from New York, and so then it was seven people, you know, that believed in us. Mm-hmm. And when you believe in yourself, nothing can stop you.
Mm.
You know what I mean?
Right.
And we believed in ourselves, and we built that band up in LA, and we kept writing, and we kept writing songs and fine-tuning songs we had, you know, like some of the songs like Rocket Queen or whatever, you probably wouldn't recognize, like, oh, the main riff's there?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, but they went into some other weird part. Like, we would fix songs by going out and playing the songs, like, oh, that didn't really work. Mm. That didn't feel right there. So we'd get back in and this little dingy rehearsal place we lived in and everything. No bathroom.
You guys lived in there.
Yeah, it was our lab, you know, and we believed in ourselves, and labels started coming out, and we started attracting bigger crowds. That's when labels started coming out. We started selling at the Troubadour, which is a big deal in L.A. You sure. go to the Troubadour now, and you look at the size of it, it's like, well, what's the big deal? It's like 220 people. But, then it was a big thing.
The Troubadour used to be kind of way bigger than it is now. It used to be one of the cornerstones of the L.A. scene, right?
Yeah, because that kind of, there was still the, what's the right word?
Mystique of it, or
yeah, from the 70s, right? From Elton John going there, and all those kind of there was a lot of bands that broke at the Troubadour, artists mm-hmm. that broke, mm-hmm. and so there was still sort of that thing. It was still Doug Weston's Troubadour, yeah. and it was so labels came out. We made this. We signed a deal with Geffen, and we made this record, and we had to find a producer. Nobody wanted to produce this. Nobody. There was this thing around us, this sort of stigma, like these guys ain't gonna live through the.
Because you had a hard partying reputation, sort of thing.
Yeah, and it was all very real. You know, like there was no bullshit about the band. It was a ball of fire. You know, like rolling around the city. But we found a guy in Mike Klink who saw us for what we were. We were in all of that. We were really dedicated musicians and songwriters and worked very hard. Mm-hmm. We would rehearse twice a day. You know, Steve and I would rehearse early in the day. You get up, you go to work. You know, we all had jobs like 6 a.m. till noon mm-hmm. or 1. Mm-hmm. And then you go to rehearsal.
Who was your job at the time?
We kind of all had the same job, like phone sales, right?
What were you selling?
I sold office supplies.
So you're calling people cold calling.
Under a different name, yeah. I was Paul Dana. but you had to have, I had a job. Mm-hmm. And that was, we all kind of grew up in a different time, like all blue collars kind of, you got to make your own way. Mm-hmm. You're not going to move to L.A. and not work. You're going to work and you're going to...
No yeah. one's giving you a credit card to live off of. When
there was
you move. No, yeah, yeah, yeah.
No, times are different now. I think they're a lot different. Mm-hmm. There just wasn't any money then either. And we grew up in the times when they're 70s and 60s and stuff. There just wasn't money. So anyhow, you pulled your own way and you go to work and then you go to rehearsal. Steven and I would rehearse every day, have rhythm section rehearsal and kind of hone that thing in. Mm. And then we'd rehearse as a band and we worked hard and we believed in that record and we made this record and I guess that to make us, I made a really long story out of a simple question.
No, but that's interesting stuff. Like you can mention just the rhythm section rehearsal because mm-hmm. The Steven Adler has a really cool vibe.
Yeah.
I don't know if anybody really plays like him. Like he's different from Matt Sorum, different from Frank Farrar.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's more of a swing thing or a little bit more sloppy, but
both of those,
both, right? Yeah,
yeah. He was a when I first answered the ad for Slash and Steven for this band Road Crew.
What was the ad? Was it in the paper or something?
Well, yeah, it was in the paper, and the guy's name was Slash. I'm not, well, he's a punk rock guy. Like I was just coming out of punk rock was kind of dead in '84. All the kind of skinhead guys started coming in from the suburbs mm-hmm. and they ruined punk rock. Like these Nazi bullshit. Like, you ain't a fucking Nazi, You're from the suburbs.
Yeah.
But this was happening all over North America.
The Oi movement, so, right?
Yeah. Just a bunch of dumb shits. Mm-hmm. But they ruined, they thought slam dancing was fighting, right? And it just, so I was like, this isn't rock and roll anymore. This is something else. Mm-hmm. So whatever was going to be next was going to be up to guys my age. And so I met the other guys my age, which were the guys in our band. Mm-hmm. But we're going to whatever's next is going to be up to us.
Right, right, right.
Whatever that is.
Yeah.
And Steven had this huge drum kit when I met him and Slash. It's like double bass drum, shit ton of toms, way too many cymbals, all this stuff. And he would play all of it at once. Where's the beat? Mm-hmm. But he had a groove in there. He had this little engine that was really interesting. Mm-hmm. And he, some people are just born to play drums, or some people are born to play guitar. And he was born to play drums. I played with drummers that shouldn't have been drummers.
Right.
It looked like such an effort back there.
Yeah.
So eventually when we, you know, Guns N' Roses became that, those five guys, Izzy and I started taking his drums away, like hiding them. So he ended up with the single kick drum, snare, no rack toms.
Really?
One floor tom, hi-hat, crash, a ride, and a cowbell.
No.
So from that huge drum kit down to this Ramones
kit. He didn't have any rack toms.
Look at pictures.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And you mentioned something.
Listen to Appetite. There's
right.
No rack toms.
You mentioned one thing too, cowbell. There's a lot of cowbell work on that record.
So he had to use what he had.
Interesting.
But our point was like, let's get to the groove.
Mm-hmm.
And Steve and I would listen to a lot of like Cameo.
Word
Sly
up.
Sly and the Family Stone. Stuff with groove and a beat.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd play along to it. And I hadn't been a bass player until... I played bass in punk rock bands. And I played guitar and punk, I played drums. I really hadn't figured out which one of those I was going to do. So I moved to LA thinking, well, I'll do one of these three. And so that band, you know, when I went to play with Steven and Slash, was a bass player. So, and then Guns started as it was. And I'm like, well, I'm going to be a bass player. So how do I do that? Which bass players do I emulate? Which style? What am I going to be?
Mm-hmm.
How am I going to be different? How am I going to be this thing? And I'd get serious about it. And back then, bass players were kind of, you know, there was Lemmy, Paul Simonon from The Clash, Nikki Sid, like Motley Crue. Like, but bass players, it was a cool thing to be. There was a band called Magazine where the bass, Killing Joke, all these bands, like the bass player was the thing. So like, let's make our rhythm section a thing. And there was also Jane's Addiction, where their rhythm section was unreal. Like, okay, we got to be unreal.
Mm-hmm.
So we'd listen to a lot of that kind of stuff and would sometimes play along to it. And then we'd play our songs with, like, let's get a real pocket.
Mm-hmm.
So you hear semblances of that sort of R&B and funk and stuff. But we made it our own thing. We made it very rock and roll. And... But it was a lot of work because I wasn't really a bass player.
That's one thing. Like I noticed, like when guitar players switch over to bass, you're still thinking almost like a guitar player in a lot of ways.
I was thinking like a drummer.
Like a drummer. Gotcha. Because your bass lines, like I say this not just because you're here and because we're friends, but your bass lines are very inventive and very cool. Like it's not just normal bass playing. It's almost like Gene Simmons plays very strange against the rhythm parts, like McCartney. Mm-hmm. You do the same thing, which is not a punk rock bass player.
Right.
You know, you're coming at it more of almost like I said, like Gene or like a Steve Harris even, where there's a lot of really cool stuff going on that's not just the root.
Right. And I mean, like punk rock is such a broad term. So I hate to even use that because you listen to The Clash and Paul Simonon did some amazing...
Yeah,
that's
true. Yeah.
You know, and then you get to Lemmy. You go to Lemmy for like just down the middle, like hate bass playing. Mm-hmm. Like, I love that too. Mm-hmm. That's more like, I guess, punk rock.
Very, also, the distorted tone that he had.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if he used a pedal or just used his Amp Murder one and turned on the distortion, but that's almost like a guitar when you listen to it, you know?
Yeah. And then there would be like other stuff like Killing Joke. And so I don't mean to put punk rock, I put anything with sort of bad intention, which I love, you know, playing with bad intentions, all into punk rock.
Like it's hard to call The Clash a punk rock band by the definition of what punk rock is, because
whatever that definition
right, like
is.
Rock the Casbah, or like, you know, Train in Vain is not a punk rock song in the least, but right. They're a punk rock band, right?
Quote, I guess, think, you know, a lot of bands tried to shake that.
Yeah, Blondie, or even The Police started as a punk band, quote-unquote.
They did. I saw them on a punk tour, you know.
Yeah, another great bass player, too, in Sting, and very underrated as a bass player.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah.
Yeah, that's like how he could sing and play those bass lines.
Yeah. You know what, I heard, you'll take appreciation of this, when he was first learning how to sing and play guitar, or play bass at the same time, he wrote a lot of songs with space like Walking on the Moon, mm-hmm. the vocal line, there's no bass line. Dun, 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 dun,
right.
Dun, bum, 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 dun, 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 dun. I thought that was always pretty cool. Like when I heard that, like a lot of the early Police tunes have that space where there's nothing going on in, right. in between, you know, to learn right. how to sing and play. Because it's hard to sing and play. You do it great, but it's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, well, you use it like anything you work at.
Yeah. When you're talking about the songs on Appetite, did you like which songs are yours that you brought to the table on that record?
It's so hard to say, you okay. know, it, because everybody has a piece of every like, mm-hmm. Like It's So Easy is a song I recorded on 4-track, a version of it. I learned how to open E tuning on guitar from Wes, my next door neighbor.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, when you learn a new tuning on guitar, you write like 19 songs. 25 minutes. Like, wow, this new tuning just opened up a whole new world.
Yeah.
So It's So Easy was a thing I recorded, and Axel loved it. You know, it's like, okay, Paradise City, I had a lyric for that, you know, with three chords. Welcome to the Jungle, the verse riff is from this old punk rock band. It was like...
That's your riff.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So there's so many riffs.
Yes, yeah.
And I hate to even say they're mine because it was such a band
mm-hmm.
thing. So I, over the years, you know, I think maybe back then, because you're young, you're 20 and 21, you're like, well, that part's mine. You know, yeah. you learn to really shake that, mm-hmm. that thing. Those were just really band songs.
Because if you look at the, you know, the track listing, it says all songs written by Guns N' Roses.
Yeah, and it's so true.
That's true, yeah. So you guys would just get together in a room and just throw shit around and...
Yeah. Worked hard. We just played a lot. We rehearsed a lot. And, you know, Axel would come in and start singing on something. He's like, well, that part's wrong. You got to change it.
Hmm.
It doesn't work. Like, well, what? Okay, what does that mean? You know, you didn't have a guitar on. It's like, well, it's got to be more angry, you know, or this part's got to be... And like, okay, well, shit. You know, and you learned, like, he has such amazing instincts. At first, you're like, well, what's this? He doesn't even play guitar. Like, what's he know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But, we'd land on something, like, after being frustrated and finally, like, Slash would play some riff, like, just being pissed off. Like, oh, there it is.
Mm.
There it is. And you'd learn, like, whatever Axel's instinct was, usually, like, the right thing, even though you'd fight through it and fight through it and fight through it and finally land on something. So, yeah.
You're basically pushing each other.
Yeah.
Right?
And like, where do we go at the end of Sweet Child was, okay, where do we go in this song now?
Where do we go now?
Yeah. So that was like a place setter lyric.
Really?
Remember. Yeah. Where do we go? In the song.
No
where do
shit.
We go now?
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. But it ended up, like, that was that band at the time, like, oh, actually, that works for the song, you know, for the previous lyric in the song, it works great.
It's great because when you think about it, it's like, it makes sense, but it doesn't really make sense, but that's the reason why. It was just the placeholder for what you wanted to do. How much of, like, kind of the unsung hero, if that's the right word, was Izzy to that process?
Oh, I mean, I don't think he's unsung.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry.
That's all right. He's putting vitamin C into your water bottle.
Yeah, and then it looks like I've done... It's my whole room. It looks like I've done cocaine. I have, you know, all these powders.
White powder all over the place. 30 years difference.
I leave my rooms in all these fancy tin suites, and they're like, oh, that guy does a lot of cocaine.
That guy from Guns N' Roses is on so much cocaine. We saw the white powder everywhere.
Yeah.
We're talking about Izzy, though?
I've heard the unsung hero, but I think he's sung... pretty well. He was, you know, a big part of that band, but everybody was, you know, Steven, you know, some of the beats that he would start would inspire a riff, you know, and how do you give that credit to a drummer who doesn't have a guitar on? How do you, you know, Axel, you got to credit him with like pushing us to get the riff for Michelle, you know?
How do you mean?
Because it was double time and it was... That original riff for Michelle wasn't the riff it was. It was this fast kind of.
So if you double times like dan dan dan, like the beat is faster.
I even forget what it was.
Oh yeah.
You know, but and Izzy had like these cool riffs and but the rest of the band would take it and make it like this whole other thing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to say. Everybody, if you want to say that anybody was unsung, then everybody was unsung.
Mm.
Or everybody was sung.
Everyone was sung.
I don't know. he was, you know, he, as he rolled, he was a super cool guy, for sure.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we all had our demons and we faced them at different times. And he had his kind of in the midst of all of that.
Early on.
Yeah. Yeah. We all had them.
Mm.
Make no mistake about it. But it was how, you know, that's a whole other story.
But that's always kind of, it was like almost the image of Guns N' Roses were like, you know, and you guys cultivated that. You know, all your pictures, you'd have like a bottle of Jack Daniels and cigarettes in hand. But that was part of the
it wasn't like we didn't have an image consultant. That was just who
we were. You
didn't
have a stylist?
No, we did not.
But I mean, it was a whole, like, in 1987, 88, that was a whole new thing. I was like, Motley Crue was like a party band, but you guys were like just dirty. The Guns N' Roses just looked like a bunch of dirty motherfuckers. And a great rock and roll band. And that was part of the beauty of your guys' vibe, I think.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You guys just didn't give a shit.
No. No.
In a time when other bands seemingly did.
Yeah, it was the real thing. I mean, there was other bands, and I won't name them, but, you know, I mean, there was just other bands in that scene that we just, oh, like if you get put in the same realm with them, like in some, like once, like Hip Raider or whatever magazines were started to write about it, like, do not put us in the same category with those bands,
like hair metal bands or something,
or whatever, mm-hmm. whatever band it was, because mm-hmm. we knew who was real and we knew who wasn't. We, you know, like we loved Fear, we loved, you know, the bands that were real around us.
But you must have loved Aerosmith as well. That's
yeah,
a
but I'm
real...
talking about the bands that were around
gotcha.
Us in LA.
Gotcha.
Jane's Addiction was a real thing. Those mm-hmm. guys were like super,
super intense. Yeah,
yeah, out there. And yeah, great. Yeah, yeah. And they were doing their own thing
mm-hmm.
for sure. And there was a bunch of bands that just were kind of copying what the other
mm-hmm.
their image and then, you know. So we just are. Image, as it were, was not. It was an anti-image. It was just us. So if you saw a picture with us with Jack or whatever, that was just they snapped a photo of us. Okay, you guys get together because you have to get together for a photo if right. you all want to be in it.
Yeah.
Here. Okay. Good. The photo session's over. You know.
Off we go.
Off we go. So a lot of those like early photo sessions, quote unquote, were all done by Mark Kander or Robert John. Two friends of ours
mm-hmm.
and we'd usually be out flyering at the time, so we'd be all together, so snap a photo being, you know,
and flyering meaning
putting up flyers for your gig
mm-hmm. and that was what the, that
that's
was the
what
scene,
we did
the Sunset Strip scene at that
yeah,
point.
Yeah, we'd
right?
get Night Train, which is $1.29 a bottle, and we'd go out and yeah put up flyers, get in fights, protect ourselves. You know, we were like a gang, do a photo shoot. Okay, all you guys, now you all have to be together to be all be in the photo. Snap. Okay, photo shoot's done.
So why would you get in fights? Because you're putting your flyer over somebody
whatever.
Else's flyer?
Yeah. You know, or whatever. Mm. It was Hollywood was a little tough then. There was some crime. There was a lot of crack cocaine. There was all kinds of... numbskullery going on there.
Numbskullery.
Talk is Jericho.
Was there any bands at that time that didn't make it that you thought could have or should have?
Mm.
Like, I always heard a lot about Jet Boy.
Yeah.
They have some steam because then the guy passed away.
Slash yeah.
his buddy or whatever, yeah.
Yeah. Todd was... I was really, really tight with Todd.
You were close to him too, right?
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. yeah.
And, yeah, they kicked him out kind of, I think, because, I mean, we took out the time because he was hanging out with us too much, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we knew when to like draw a line, like gigs were off.
Like, don't be wasted for a gig.
Yeah. The off limits, mm-hmm. like, you know, but every other time there was no limit. So you could either hang with us or you couldn't. Like, some people would come in and try to hang with us. They, you know, you knew like that person's gonna last a couple hours. and they're going to be gone.
You'd be puking yeah. in 2 hours. Yeah,
you get in the scrum, and some people could hang with us and mm-hmm. just stay in the scrum.
Mm-hmm.
And Todd was one of those guys. And but Jet Boy was definitely cool. We played a bunch of shows with them early on.
Mm-hmm.
They had
mm-hmm.
their own kind of vibe, and I don't really know what happened. They made a record that didn't sound great. That record of theirs, that mm-hmm. first mm-hmm. record. They did. I don't know who produced it, but it didn't sound great. It didn't sound like them.
Mm-hmm.
I know with Clink and us, that was the thing we wanted to do. We didn't want to use any studio trickery or try to be, you know, like then, you know, there was that like docking sort of snare sound and stuff that everybody was using with mm-hmm. where they put dynamite and stuff. Remember all those?
Yeah, it was like a real sharp.
They would recorded dynamite, and that was in the drum. They would put samples of stuff in the snare drum and all of that.
Yeah.
There was a lot of that.
Okay.
Triggering drum sounds to make them sound bigger. And like, we don't want to do any of that because we had a feeling then, like, that's all just going to be a thing in passing. Let's, like, records that sound great are Ace of Spades, you know, and Led Zeppelin records and Aerosmith records. Those records sound great. We want to sound great.
Mm-hmm.
Like that. Like put mics up to our stuff and record that.
And just go, yeah.
So Clink really got that. So we wanted to make a record that sounded like us. And there were some bands in that time that suddenly you hear the record like, that's not the band.
Mm-hmm.
That's and it put them on a click track or whatever. So that band is better than that,
mm-hmm.
a lot better than that. And I think Jet Boy was with that. That was one of those cases.
But for you guys, like you mentioned, like your bass tone on Appetite, you must have been super happy with that because it sounds great.
Yeah,
it sits so up front in the mix.
We cultivated good tones because mm-hmm. we played so much, we mm-hmm. rehearsed so much, and like this to sound good. And we got that record advanced, and I knew the gear I wanted because the Guitar Center was right in front of our place, and I'd go, I'd be that guy who came in and played. Look, one day I'm gonna get this, and,
yeah, right.
Oh, that guy's not gonna buy it again,
yeah, get today. Out. No Stairway,
yeah. So, that was my bass tone,
mm-hmm.
and still basically use the same stuff,
same gear,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. What guitar did you use to record that album?
The bass I have now, I still have that bass, but the basses I play every night,
what are they?
They're Fender Jazz Specials, they were called. They only made them for 1 year. They were made in Japan, and I got one. And it's the Roto Sound strings I use with it. It's the GK head I use with that. Seymour Duncan pickups. Mm-hmm. It's the pick I use. It's a whole thing that mm-hmm. creates this tone. And I use the same stuff.
To this day.
I do.
Yeah.
You know, I play with my fingers a little bit now. I really got into bass about eight to 10 years ago. I started taking lessons.
Really?
Yeah, I did. And I got re-inspired on the bass and really wanted to learn like some theory and stuff. So I learned some theory and I kind of threw it away. But I started playing with my fingers and kind of expanding my
Your bass horizons. Yeah.
You know, and I play a lot like before we play a show, I'll play for like 2 hours, which is something I didn't do back then.
Mm-hmm.
But we played so much. We rehearsed so much that I didn't have to go home and play.
Mm-hmm.
Home was actually our place we rehearsed.
Yeah.
When
you guys were getting ready for this tour and rehearsing again, mm-hmm. Did you remember the songs very easily, or was it hard to get back into that Guns N' Roses groove? Because it was 20 years.
It wasn't hard. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, you know, those songs are, they're part of your makeup. Mm-hmm. So your body kind of suddenly like adheres to the thing.
Right.
I mean, I remember I listened to Appetite and played along to, I have this little setup where I can play along to music. Like this, first time I ever played cover songs was just recently, this Kings of Chaos thing.
Right.
So I'm playing like Deep Purple. And
it's like an all-star cover band. Yeah.
Yeah, you're playing with the guys. Like,
yeah.
And like real Texas Shuffle with ZZ Top, like playing those songs. Like, whoa, this is cool.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Aerosmith songs, like playing them real, like not as like a cover band, but you're playing with Steven Tyler. You're going to play, this is going to be perfect.
Yeah.
Deep Purple with Glenn Hughes, those right. songs.
What a great singer he is, man. Amazing. I love Glenn.
Yeah. Playing guy. Cheap Trick songs with Robin Zander. You know? Yeah,
that's cool.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
But first time I played cover songs, so I got this little setup where I got, you know, this blaster that plays the music, and then I have a little bass amp, and I learn the songs, play them over and over and over and learn them. I don't read music. Mm-hmm. I don't really need to. Mm-hmm. You just get in the tuning, whatever it is. Some of those old 70s songs, they weren't really in tune with
right.
anything. So yeah. you got to tune yeah. to the record, you know. Okay, here I am. All right. Mm-hmm. What was my point of that? So I had my little setup with Appetite. I put Appetite up and played through the record. And then the Illusion songs. And it got into the Chinese Democracy right. songs.
I think that's cool that you play some tunes from that record.
It's great. You know, yeah. Axel is, you know, he put a lot into that record. Mm-hmm. And there's I think Slash and I were like challenged with a thing like, how do we make these kind of ours?
Yeah,
now?
Yeah, sure.
Because we're going to play these. So we're going to take ownership mm-hmm. of these. And we went in and started. Like, we learned them first and then went in and started playing with Frank. And then Richard came in, but like, let's tear these songs down first to really know them. Mm-hmm. So it was just Slash and I and Frank playing some of these, like, Better and mm-hmm. Chinese Democracy songs. And
what else did you do? This I Love? Is that another one that you guys do?
We do. We know yeah. a bunch of them.
Yeah,
you know, it depends on in the set. But let's tear these songs down and really get to know them and then build it up from there.
Mm-hmm.
And so my point to that is, all the Illusion stuff and Appetite, it didn't take long mm-hmm. at all. It took mm-hmm. a day.
Is there
like,
one?
Okay, I got it.
Is there one song or what's the hardest song to play in your set? I mean, I'm sure you got them all down, but is there one where you're like a little bit more challenging? Like I got to really not run around during this one?
I mean, there's a few where I can't really run around personally. You know, a bass player, like I play guitar in Loaded. I play rhythm guitar, which is the best instrument to play, period.
yeah.
You know?
No kidding, right?
Because you got big open chords and, you know, and you can go thrashing around.
Yeah. And if you don't play a couple verses or you don't have to worry about
well,
it.
Well, you can hit a chord and run.
Yeah.
You know, and
yeah.
that thing's ringing.
Mm-hmm.
Bass, there's no ringing. You have to play. So if you're running, you have to know, like, you have to be on.
Yeah. Yeah.
With
yeah,
your
yeah.
right hand.
On
there's
point,
no,
right?
there's, or it's going to sound like a bar band.
Mm-hmm.
The bass and drums cannot.
Right.
It just cannot deviate too much.
Yes.
At all. So, yeah, I can't. But, you know, I think the most challenging. There's just little parts, like the beginning of Sweet Child of Mine, where the bass comes in. That's you can't fuck that up.
Right.
Everybody there is listening.
Yeah.
At that point, everybody's like, whoa. So you can't be like, you got to be on. So like, okay, this is, and there's Slash guitar solo. So I'm thinking about it. You're not going from one song into that song in our set right now.
Uh-huh.
He does this long.
Oh, okay, he's got the Godfather thing that he
so
does.
So I'm
yeah.
sitting there with my middle finger sitting on the first note
mm-hmm.
for like 5 minutes.
Just waiting.
Thinking about it, yeah.
But what an iconic part. That's what I was talking about earlier. Like, what a great musical part of a song where like you know that bass line as if it was a vocal line.
Yeah.
Everyone knows it,
mm-hmm.
you know? Another one I think of, too, is at the end of Paradise City when it gets fast.
Yeah.
Digga, 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 digga. You're yeah. walking the dog on that one.
Yeah.
You know?
So we just throw down at the end of Paradise. That's the end of the set.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's challenging parts for sure, but we play a lot. And I wouldn't say anything estranged. You know, you don't want to fuck up that song.
Yeah.
At all.
You know, it's funny, when that record came out, I never liked that song because I was, you know, 21 years old.
Yeah.
And he's an 8-minute ballad or whatever.
Yeah.
That's one of my favorite songs in your set. It's such a great tune.
Thanks. Yeah.
You know, when you're younger, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. oh, come on, I want to hear It's So Easy. I want to hear rock songs. I don't want ballads.
Yeah.
But then when you grow up and mature a bit, it's like, what a great tune that is, man. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It's a great tune. Mm-hmm. I agree with you.
Just a few more questions as we wind down here. First of all, did you have any say, or did you see that?
Oh, wait.
What do you got?
And you know what? You know what I got you?
Is this a present for me?
Well, we can share.
Okay. We got a bag of almonds.
Wait. Go. Keep
here we go. Okay, we got a bag of almonds that Duff gave me because we became almond buddies in Australia when we were both on the paleo diet. And we had nothing to eat, and Duff was super hungry. And I was like, hey, man, I got some almonds. He's like, you got some almonds? And it's the famous story. Like, you know, back in the day, we would be exchanging pills. Yeah. You holding? And then we're exchanging almonds.
So I'm on the flight. We flew here from Ottawa.
Right.
This far. Our buses took off like when we got to Ottawa to come here.
You guys have your own plane, or do you fly commercially?
No, flew commercial.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That'd be pretty cool. Guns N' Roses on the plane.
Yeah, it was, you know, there was people that were at the show the night before. Hey, can I get a picture? Sorry.
Hey, man, can I get one of them autographs from you, maybe, or a picture? Oh, sorry.
Well,
okay, sorry.
Shit, man. Well, here's the deal. They gave us almonds on the flight. I'm like, and I threw some in my bag for you, Jericho.
I'm your almond. You said Steve Jones is your spirit animal, and I'm your almond animal.
Is this the almond? No.
That's like some kind of a bar or something.
It really is. That could be years old.
You had this in 1987, I think, this bar here. What is it? Dude, it's like you've got like some kind of an Arabic candy bar. It's got,
is that right?
Yeah, look at it. It's got Arabic writing on it. It's like you must have got this when you were in Tel Aviv.
Sit in my bag for a minute.
Oh, that's great.
Oh, well, I can't find my... Anyhow,
okay, so you got some other almonds, too.
I did. I got you a little bag of almonds.
Well, thanks, man. Yeah. I appreciate that. Whenever you see almonds, you think of me.
Yeah.
Right?
I got to get these for Jericho.
Were you ever privy to the original cover of Appetite? Is that something that you would be involved with, where you see that cover with like the robot and the chicks like insinuated that she just got raped?
Axel found that it was on like a little postcard on Melrose. It was the artist.
Really?
Yeah. So he loved the image. There was a few images that we had looked at, and he found that one. He's like, he brought it to our little rehearsal place. He's like, check this out. And Robert, what's it? Escaping me right now.
With the Robert the John?
No.
Whoever wrote, yeah, the guy who drew, I don't know his name is, but the guy who drew it.
Yeah. Famous, like, you know, kind of hot rod artist and all that kind of stuff. Robert Williams.
Okay, there you go.
And it was one of his images, and our record company contacted him, and we, whatever, licensed the image or whatever you do. And that became... It was such a kind of a perfect image. It was like he brought it in. We're all like, oh, there it is.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
But they wouldn't let you use it. It was too controversial.
We used it. It was on the first like 50,000 copies. And then it got changed because it was...
so controversial.
But, you know, yeah, but that time, you know, with the stickers and all that back then, they still have the stickers?
I don't think so. You know about like the PMRC and all that stuff?
Yeah, she was great. Al Gore's wife, Tipper Gore.
Yeah.
Was great for selling records back then. Her intent was to like kind of
stop
blackball anything with coarse language on it or whatever subject matter. But those stickers, parental warning stickers, sold records for anybody who had that on their record.
It worked against, yeah. I was in a punk band in high school called Tipper Gory.
Oh, were you really?
I always loved that name, Tipper Gory.
Tipper Gory. Yeah. Tipper, she really had, I'm sure... I don't know. I wonder if Al was ever kind of just embarrassed by that.
I'm sure. We just let her do it, what she wants. Oh, God, you know, just keep her, get her out of the house and quit from yelling at us. So 30 years later with Appetite, and this is kind of a weird question, but why do you think it got so huge? Like, what was it about Appetite that made it the album of that decade in a lot of ways?
It's probably impossible for me, being inside of that, to answer that.
Right.
You know, I can't see our band like other people see it from the
great
outside.
Point.
You know, I got to say, when I went through and played that record before we went into rehearsal a couple Januaries ago, I was like, oh, you know, I got this feeling, oh, this record rocks. You know, this is,
yeah.
You can just hear the energy and the, that record really captured that band really well. And those were a lot of like first and second takes.
Really?
On that record. Yeah, because we were playing so much. There might have been a third take on there.
Did you guys record all together or was it separate?
We recorded all together.
Wow.
Yeah, but you know, like Slash put guitar on after, but we recorded the bass and drums are
that's cool.
That's
too.
The energy, right? That the initial energy that everything's based off of, and we are all playing with one another. So it is that full energy. I think some of the, a lot of that stuff is guitar just stayed on there. He didn't do it over. It's like, well, no, I mean. It sounds
Yeah.
It's fine.
Yeah.
His amp was in another room, so it was isolated. You didn't need to do it over. A lot of times you got to do some of those like guitars over again or bass or whatever because the drums have bled into it.
Right.
It doesn't sound great.
Mm-hmm.
You don't want a guitar track with a bunch of drums on it. You want it just a guitar track. But when you isolate the amps, of course, with mics on them in different rooms and you don't have that bleed, sometimes you can just keep that.
Mm-hmm.
And with me playing bass with a drummer on anything I've done, I like to have good isolation because a lot of time just playing with the drummer that in that moment, that's the best take you're going to get.
Yeah.
Because there's just a lot more thing. When you play bass again over the drum track, you don't have the line of sight with him. You know, I love having that line of sight with the drummer, being right on a drummer in the studio.
Locked in, yeah.
Locked in,
yeah. What's your favorite song on Appetite?
God, I don't know. I've been asked that. I mean, we're playing Michelle a lot right now. It's a great song, but then when we play Out to Get Me, I'm like, oh, that's
song. Angry tune also, yeah. What a great tune.
And Night Train's a great song, you know, like this super great, and it brings up a really fun memory of that. Those, you know, going out and flying and drinking Night Train.
$1.29.
I'm on the Night Train. That stuff. The reason you say you're on the Night Train because it wasn't just booze. It was like so much sugar and they must have dosed it with something else. Acid or something. I'm not sure.
Liquid LSD or something. Yeah.
So.
Is that how it works? Like every day, like when you guys do a show, I'm assuming Axel probably writes the set list and like just gives it to you guys.
We have a set list that's out there. And then, you know, Axel, we have these little boxes on stage that you can just, we wear in-ears, right? So most of the time he's telling amazing jokes.
To you guys?
Amazing.
That only you can hear.
Yeah.
That's great.
He crushes everybody in the, like, you know, I fancy myself a humorist.
Yeah. A jokester?
A jokester, but he crushes me. But, you know, it's like, hey, let's play.
You just call it, you call it on the fly.
Yeah.
That's great.
Because
you do a lot of covers, too, I noticed.
We do. We do, like, the Layla thing in November Rain. And before that is a piece of Wish You Were Here. Live and Let Die, of course.
Yeah.
Knock on Heaven's Door.
Yeah. There's a couple of AC/DC tunes now.
We will.
Yeah.
Yeah. Angus has come out with us.
That's great.
If we're near where Angus is, he'll come up.
Did you go see Axel when he sang?
A couple times.
He killed it, man.
Killed it.
I love that.
Yeah.
I thought he did so great.
Yeah, it was, Slash and I flew to London with our ladies surprised him.
Oh, did you?
Yeah.
That's cool. See, that's cool. You got that camaraderie. Mm-hmm. Just, you know what I mean? I'm sure he appreciated that to see you guys there.
Yeah, he was, you know, I mean, think about it. I've gone and played with a bunch of other bands, and so Slash has played with so many other artists. And Axel never really got the chance to do that.
Right.
And this was like, he went and tried out, did the whole thing. You know,
really?
He was super nervous.
Because that's another level, too. Like, that's AC/DC.
It's AC/DC.
Right?
And Bon is his guy. So it was a big thing. When he left to go try out, you know, he came. He's like, oh, man, I don't know. Like, dude, you have it. Oh, I don't know, man. I mean, I don't know. I'm just going to go try out and just go see, you know. And we knew he had it.
But you have to think, like, I would almost wonder, like, if Angus Young even knows who Guns N' Roses is. You know what I mean? Like, he's so, like, it's Angus, right? Like, Guns N' Roses? Which one are they? You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
But I, you said something perfect that I loved about it was when Brian Johnson sang the Bond songs, he did a great job. But he did it because I think that's part of his gig.
Mm-hmm.
Axel, I think, embodies the spirit of Bon Scott.
Yeah.
and is a Bond guy. So those Bond songs have a whole new life with him singing them.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's the one thing I loved about seeing AC/DC was it's like having the reincarnation of Bond Scott and with the swagger and like the danger.
Yeah.
You know, it was really, really cool.
Yeah.
You know, it was fun to watch.
Yeah. I agree.
Yeah.
So, yeah. So I saw him in London, then I went to Cleveland and saw him do it again.
Yeah. Last couple of questions. Did you, being a Seattle guy, were you buds with Chris Cornell?
Yeah.
Yeah. What a drag. I saw him 2 days before he passed away at a festival in northern Wisconsin or someplace like that. But yeah, just like the total shock, man. Like the Seattle scene, man, there's some crazy shit.
Yeah,
I
really have no words for that. My daughter, May, and his daughter, Lily, were born 2 weeks apart.
Oh, wow.
And I was Susan and I, we were in Seattle then. So Susan Silver and my Susan were pregnant at the same time. Mm. And we hung out a bunch when the girls were little babies. And then Audioslave started when Velvet Revolver started. And we played gigs with them.
And, same vibe, too. Both of your bands...
Same vibe.
And then start a new band, mm-hmm. a super group thing, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
With Weiland as well. Mm-hmm. It's amazing how that scene, I talked with Corey Taylor about this. Weiland, Chris Cornell, Lane Staley, Andrew Wood. It's like all of these, Kurt Cobain, you know what I mean? It's like all of the guys from that era have all gone, you know? So,
those guys are all my age, you know? And I don't know, man. The more it happens with Chris was a shocker. You know, I've had little touches of depression in the last 7-8 years. Came out of nowhere. I'm not that guy. Mm-hmm. But I've had panic disorder since I was 16. And they always said that's a subset of depression.
Hmm.
I'm like, well, I don't have depression.
Mm-hmm.
I have panic attacks here and there, like in the weirdest places ever. And I've learned to deal with them. I know I'm not going to. You know, I learned by the time I was 20, I'm not going to die from a panic attack. Mm-hmm. You feel like you're going to. So, like when I was about 5 years ago, I was in a movie theater with my wife, Susan. We went to the movies. And my seat sunk down 5 feet in the middle of the movie. And I looked around. I thought something happened to the theater.
Hmm.
Like there was an earthquake. But I had like an attack of depression. Just a feeling of moroseness. And if I couldn't live like that, we got out of the theater and I'm shaking and I think, you know, it's hard to explain what I felt like, but she drove me home. We got, my friend came over, we got somebody else on the phone and, it was depression. And it passed. And then I went and saw some people about it. And, I had a couple more of those episodes, but sometimes I think I get things so I can write about it. Cause like you, I'm a writer.
Mm-hmm.
Like, okay, now I've experienced that. I wrote a column about depression and because I know now about it,
mm-hmm.
I don't have chronic depression, but I've had attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So if my point is if Chris Chester or, you know, anybody that see, like if there was depression involved, then all bets are off. I can't, I'm not going to judge him anyhow.
No.
I've been in and out of, you know, alcohol and drug addiction, and I got it all, you know? So I can't. I'm not one to judge.
Mm.
But if there was depression involved, then...
It's a real thing.
It's a real thing, because I understand. When I sunk down into that 5 feet down in that movie theater, I couldn't live like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
you couldn't.
Yeah.
You can't breathe. You can't eat, you can't, you know, you're all your body function, like just go.
Yeah.
You have no control.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a strong dude. You know, like I think positive and I apply a lot of principles to my life and through martial arts and through stuff. And I can see and deal with shit, bad shit, you know, and good shit.
Mm-hmm.
And be a dad and be all, you know, those things that I rise to because I love it. But when I had the depression, I couldn't be any of those things.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I couldn't be anything.
Right. Yeah. Like you said, it's a real thing. But okay, last question.
Okay.
Knock, knock.
Okay, who's there?
Little old lady.
Little old lady who?
I didn't know you could yodel.
Hey.
All right.
Knock, knock.
Who's there?
Minnow.
Minnow who?
Oh, yeah. If you got a better knock, knock joke, let me know.
Dude, thank you so much, man.
Okay. Okay, see you. Bye.
I think I'm the only guy that can go toe-to-toe with Duff McKagan on knock-knock jokes. Great guy. He actually sent me a joke today, and I'll read it to you. Duff's joke says, what's the difference between a peeping Tom and a pickpocket? One snatches your watch. Yeah, think about that one. Duff and I exchanging brutal jokes, and more importantly, exchanging another great conversation. Duff is such a great guest. What a great guy. One of my favorite people on the planet, and what a huge coup that he granted his one and only long-term full-length interview with Talk is Jericho ever since the Guns N' Roses reunion. Thanks again to Duff to talk about Appetite for Destruction and the reunion tour and Axl Rose and Angus Young and everything else. Guns N' Roses spent the summer playing stadiums, and now they're moving the show indoors this fall with a round of arena dates. GunsN'Roses.com has all the dates and ticket info. And I'll tell you what, if you haven't seen the show, go. They are on fire. They were amazing in Winnipeg when I saw them later on that night. Amazing in Edmonton. They played a Glenn Campbell cover. They played a James Brown cover. All the songs sound great. The chemistry is great. Axl's singing amazing. And Duff told me off the air that this is the best tour he's ever been on, and they're having so much fun. And hopefully there'll be some new music at that point. So let's just wait and see what happens. But go see Guns N' Roses. They are unbelievable. And speaking of unbelievable, how about more unbelievable news headlines as only Team Tiger Awesome can deliver them?
This is the news with Team Tiger Awesome. In Time Travel Paradox news, our story editor Gary recently traveled back in time to see if it was possible to kill his own grandfather. Gary left on his journey before he wrote an ending to this segment, so best of luck, Gary, and more on this story as it develops. In crazy mystery news, a random human named Gary, whom nobody has ever heard of, ceased to exist yesterday. Authorities aren't really baffled and had no comment. And now a look at the Monkey Business Report. They are bankrupt again. On a call with shareholders, CFO Pickles said they simply overestimated the market while carrying too large an inventory. Outside analysts, meanwhile, say they're monkeys. They mean well, but, I mean, come on. They're monkeys. For more upsettingly silly news, listen to the Team Tiger Awesome Show every Sunday on the Jericho Network, right here on Podcast One.
That's right. Start every Sunday morning with a laugh. The Team Tiger Awesome Show. Subscribe at Apple Podcasts. And be sure to leave them a 5-star rating and review as well. Leave all the Jericho Network podcasts 5-star ratings and reviews at Apple Podcasts. Killing the Town with Storm and Cyrus. They go and debate about the sexy star controversy. She's banned from Talk is Jericho for life. And also they filmed a little bit of a live performance as they opened up the show for the Words of Jericho show in Winnipeg that Duff was going to come to. I had tickets reserved for him, but he couldn't make it. But that's going to be this week on Storm and Cyrus, Killing the Town, Rock Talk with Mitch LaFon. This week he's talking to Slim Jim Phantom and Tracy Guns from LA Guns. Raven Effect, so funny. In-depth conversations with Raven and Busby Berkeley talking about the current wrestling scene, which Raven has not been familiar with. He's getting back into it. And, of course, Keeping It 100 with Conan, my favorite show of the week. Check that out. And then, of course, Beyond the Darkness. Get your paranormal fix every weekday with brand-new episodes 5 days a week. And Dave and Tim also do True Crime Tuesday. You can get that by signing up at patreon.com for $5 a month. You get a new episode every Tuesday, and they're all commercial free. No commercials. Sign up now at patreon.com for some true crime stories that will chill your blood. Thank you for listening, and another thank you to all the Sexy Beast Talk is Jericho sponsors and all of you for supporting the great sponsors that make this free twice a week and make it possible for me to do this show. I'm talking about Leah Remini, Scientology in the Aftermath. Watch new episodes every Tuesday at 9 Eastern, 8 Central, 9 and 8. Don't miss it. It is, like I said, it's wow. It is chilling, this show. I'm really addicted to it. FanDuel. Go to FanDuel.com, F-A-N-D-U-E-L. Use my promo code Jericho to play for free with no deposit. DDP Yoga. Go to DDPYoga.com/Jericho. Get 25% off the DDP Yoga DVDs and all DDP swag. UFC 215 this Saturday, September 9th. That's live from Edmonton, Alberta, Canada. And, of course, get your new or used car from True Car. Go do it now. Thank you for listening. Keep listening for the 60-second AP News headlines coming up next. And coming up this Friday, Nick Santo is going to be here. He is amazing. Why is he amazing? He's a bodybuilder. He's a drummer. He wrestled in high school. He's a motivational speaker. Oh, and by the way, he's got one arm with one finger and no legs. It is an incredible story from Nick Santos. Inspiration. I was lucky enough to sit down with him in Tampa, Florida, and hear his inspirational story. He was born with no legs and one arm with one finger. Okay? You think you got a bad day? You think you got problems to overcome? Wait till you hear the inspirational, incredible story of Nick Santos this Friday on Talk is Jericho. You're going to dig him, I promise. So check it. Stay tuned for that. Go crank up some Guns N' Roses. And in the meantime, in the between time, stay hard. Stay hungry. Peace, love, and hugs, and a big yeah, boy. And go eat some almonds as well.
Listen to new episodes of Talk is Jericho every Wednesday and Friday on the Podcast One app or subscribe at Apple Podcasts or PodcastOne.com.